The motorcade of black chaikas crossed the moat bridge and entered the fortress of the Kremlin through the gate below the Borovitskaya Tower. The two Cuban generals rode in the leading limousine. Senen Casas Requerion was chief of staff of the Cuban army, and with him was his army logistics chief. Colonel General Ramon Machado was in the second vehicle with President Fidel Castro, acting as host and interpreter for the visiting head of state. Ramon's promotion had been announced within weeks of his return from Ethiopia, where he had masterminded the abdication of the Emperor Haile Selassie, the abolition of the monarchy, and the formal declaration by the Ethiopian Derg of a Marxist socialist state. He was now the second youngest general in the entire Russian military service, and by far the youngest in the KGB. His immediate senior in the Secret Service was 53 years of age. His predecessor, Joe Cicero, had only been elevated to general officer rank just before his retirement. The promotion was all the more extraordinary in that Ramon was not a Russian national by birth. His naturalization papers had only been serviced 8 years ago. Ethiopia had been a triumph for him. He had steered the first stage of the revolution through without any visible Russian presence in the country, and, more importantly, with the expenditure of a paltry few million rubles. Following immediately had been his clandestine but equally successful visit to Luanda, in Angola, where Ramon had met the Red Admiral Rosa Contino. Contino was a member of the Portuguese Communist Party. He had been appointed Governor-General of Angola by the left-wing Military Forces Committee, which now governed Portugal. He had been charged with organizing the popular elections to select an African government to bring the former Portuguese colony of Angola to independence. However, during his meeting with Ramon, he had proven to be a political soulmate. "We must ensure that under no circumstances popular elections take place," he had told Ramon. "If we allow that to happen, then Jonas Savimbi will be the first president of Angola, if only because his Ovimbundu tribe is the largest in the country." "We cannot allow it," Ramon agreed. He did not have to elaborate. Jonas Savimbi was the boldest and most successful of all the Angolan guerrilla leaders. His UNITA army had fought the Portuguese with skill and dogged determination for a decade. He was intelligent, educated, and strong-willed. Although he had never declared his political allegiances, he was certainly not a Marxist, probably not even a socialist, and they could not take a chance on him coming to power. "The only possible solution," Ramon went on, "is for you to declare that, owing to the state of chaos in the country, it will be impractical to hold elections. You should then declare that the solution is to recognize the MPLA as the only party capable of assuming the reins of government, and to persuade Lisbon to transfer power to Agostinho Neto and the MPLA as soon as possible." Neto was the Soviet choice. He was devious, weak, cruel, and malleable. He could be controlled, whereas Savimbi could not. "I agree," Contino nodded. "But can I count on full support from Russia and Cuba?" "If I am able to promise you that support, will you be prepared to hand over to us strategic military bases and airfields, to allow us to rush in troops and military supplies?" Ramon countered. "You have my hand on it." The Red Admiral stretched across his desk, and Ramon took his hand with a soaring sense of triumph. He was about to deliver two nations into Soviet sovereignty. Surely no single man had achieved more in Africa. "I am flying directly from here to Havana," he assured Contino. "I anticipate that within a matter of days, talks between Cuba and Moscow will be underway at the highest possible level. I will have your answer for you by the end of the month." Contino rose to his feet. "You are an extraordinary man, Comrade Colonel General. Seldom have I been privileged to work with one who sees so clearly to the very heart of a problem, and who is prepared to deliver the bold, expert cut of a surgeon to excise it." Now Ramon sat in the rear seat of the Chaika with President Fidel Castro beside him as they entered the citadel of Soviet socialism. The cavalcade, led by the motorcycle escort, moved swiftly up the broad cobbled avenue. They passed the famous armory, the great treasure house of Imperial Russia, which still housed a stunning wealth of ambassadorial gifts and Tsarist regalia, from the crown of Ivan the Terrible to the jewel-encrusted court robes of Catherine the Great. A queue of foreign tourists at the doors of the museum watched them pass. their expressions lighting with curiosity as they recognized the great bearded figure of Castro in the second car. Swiftly they moved on, passing on their left the square around which were clustered the cathedrals of the Archangel, of the Annunciation and of the Assumption. The immense spires and towers and golden domes burnt in the pale spring sunshine. The peach and cherry trees in the gardens were in full blossom. They swung into the square, past the palace of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet, and drew up at the front entrance of the Council of Ministers building. There was an honour guard paraded to welcome them, and a dozen political and military dignitaries. Deputy Minister Alexei Yudinich stepped forward to embrace Castro and lead him into the Council of Ministers. In the Hall of Mirrors, Castro began to speak from his seat at the head of the long table. He spoke clearly, pausing at the end of each sentence to allow the Russian translator to catch up with him. Even Ramon, as an old and intimate comrade in arms, was fascinated by his grasp of the African situation and his calculated assessment of the risks and options open to them. He had absorbed every word of Ramon's briefing. "The Western Europeans are divided and spineless. NATO depends militarily on America. They would never be able to muster any organized response to our determined entrance into the Angolan arena. We need not waste serious thought on them."
"What about America?" Yudinich asked soberly.
"America is still bleeding from the humiliation of Vietnam. Their Senate will never allow American troops to operate in Africa. The Americans have been whipped. They are still snivelling with their tails between their legs. The only threat they pose is that they might choose a surrogate army to fight for them."
"South Africa," Yudinich forestalled him.
"Yes, South Africa has the most dangerous army in Africa. Kissinger may recruit them and send them across the Angolan border."
"Can we afford to fight the South Africans? Their lines of supply are shorter than ours by 10,000 miles, and their troops are reputed to be the finest bush fighters in Africa. If they are equipped and supplied by America..."
"We won't have to fight them," Castro promised. "As they cross the border, America and South Africa will be immediately defeated, not by Soviet or Cuban might, but by the practice of white minority government and the policy of apartheid."
"Explain this to us, Mr. President," Yudinich invited.
"In the West, there is such a desire by American liberals and the European anti-apartheid movement to destroy the white regime in South Africa, that they will make any sacrifice to that end. They will sacrifice Angola rather than let South Africans defend it. The moment the first South African crosses the border, our war will be won. There will be such an outcry from the American Democratic Party and from the champions of so-called democracy in Europe that the South Africans will never get to do any fighting. In the face of hysterical and worldwide condemnation, they will be forced to retire. Their attempted intervention will settle the matter firmly in our favour. Once the South Africans have tarnished the shield, no Western politician will dare to take it up again. Angola will be ours." They were all nodding agreement, all the generals and ministers. Castro had amazed Ramon once again with his powers of rhetoric and persuasion. It was the main reason that Ramon had prevailed upon him to come to Moscow in person. None of Castro's generals or ministers would have been able to swing the issue, as he had just done. His shrewd and devious view would appeal irresistibly to the Russian mind. "He calls me the Golden Fox," Ramon smiled to himself, "but he is the king of all the foxes." However, Castro was not yet finished. His timing was consummate. He smiled genially down the long table, stroking the curling bush of his beard. "Angola will be ours, but that will be only the beginning. After Angola, the ultimate prize is South Africa itself." They all leant forward eagerly, their eyes shining like a pack of wolves scenting blood. "Once we have Angola, we will have South Africa surrounded, with bases on her very borders, from which our black freedom fighters can strike with impunity. South Africa is the treasury and economic powerhouse of the whole of Africa. Once we have it, the rest of the continent will fall into our laps." He placed his huge hands palm down on the tabletop and leant forward over them. "I pledge you all the fighting men we need to do the job, 100,000 if necessary. If you provide the weapons and equipment and transport, there is a ripe fruit for the plucking. Shall we do it, comrades?
Shall we make the bold and courageous stroke together?
Only a month later, a group of Portuguese military officers loyal to the Red Admiral Coutinho handed over the strategic military airbase at Sorimo to Colonel Angel Botelho, who was chief of logistics in the Cuban Air Force. Sorimo was 500 miles inland from the capital of Luanda, and therefore comparatively secure from surveillance by the CIA and other Western agencies. The first Aleutian Candid transport landed at Sorimo 24 hours later. On board were a full cargo of military equipment and 50 Cuban advisers. The Russian military observer on the same aircraft was Colonel General Ramon Machado. It was an exhausting but exciting period for Ramon. His reputation and his nickname were swiftly spreading the length and breadth of the continent. The Cuban contingent brought the name with them from Havana. "El Zorro," they whispered it abroad. "El Zorro has arrived. Now things will begin to happen." Like the Fox, his namesake, he was constantly on the move. He seldom slept two consecutive nights in the same bed. Often there was no bed at all but the mud floor of a grass hut, the cramped seat of a light aircraft, or the dirty wooden deck of a small launch threading its way through the swamps and sandbars of a remote African river. El Yefi had been right, as usual. There was no concerted Western response to the Cuban build-up. Admiral Coutinho was able to head off the few timid inquiries, while Western journalists were successfully prevented from collecting hard evidence in the field. The arms and troops were flown in to Sorimo, or shipped to Brazzaville in the Congo, and distributed from there by light aircraft and river launch to the MPLA cadres in their camps deep in the bush. Angola was only one of many operations that Ramon was running simultaneously. There were Ethiopia and Mozambique to deal with, as well as his network of agents and the coordination of the activities of the South African freedom fighters. Angola was a marvellous new springboard for the liberation movements. Ramon set up training camps for both SWAPO, the Southwest African People's Organization, and the ANC, the African National Congress. The headquarters of the two organizations were sited in separate areas of the country. SWAPO were in the south, where they were able to cross the border into Southwest African Namibia, and to operate amongst their own tribes, the Ovahimbo and the Ovambo. However, Ramon maintained a particular interest in the ANC. He never lost sight for a moment of the fact that South Africa was the gateway to the entire continent, and the ANC were the freedom fighters of South Africa. Rally Tabaka, his old comrade from London, was promoted to ANC Chief of Logistics in Angola. Between them, they chose the site for the main ANC base in northern Angola. They flew hundreds of hours together in an Antonov military biplane. They scoured the northern seaside province of Congo before they found a site suitable for their base. It was a small fishing village situated on a lagoon and estuary of the Chikamba River. The mouth of the lagoon was open to the Atlantic, and at high tide vessels of 200 or so tons burden could cross the bar and enter the river. In addition, there were extensive fields of peasant cultivation a few miles upstream. Although these had been neglected during the savage decade of civil war, it would require very little effort to open a landing strip over the level, deforested fields. The fishing village had likewise been abandoned during the war, and there was no local population which otherwise would have had to be evacuated or eliminated. However, the main recommendation for the site was its distance from any South African border or base. The South Africans were formidable opponents. Like the Israelis, they would not hesitate to violate any international border in hot pursuit of a guerrilla unit. Chikamba was out of range of the South African Alouette helicopters, and thousands of kilometres of mountain and jungle isolating it from an overland, hostile expedition by the Boers. They named the base Tercio. Rally Tabaka took the first cadre of 500 ANC recruits up to the Tercio base in a fishing trawler requisitioned by Admiral Coutinho from the Portuguese canning factory in Luanda. They began construction work on the airstrip and training camp immediately. When Ramon flew in 10 days later, the airstrip had been cleared and levelled and was in the process of being surfaced in red clay and gravel that would set like concrete and ensure a good all-weather runway. On his second inspection, Ramon was so impressed by the remoteness and security of the area that he decided to set up a separate compound near the mouth of the river, overlooking the beach. He planned this as his own private headquarters. He always needed a secure base for communications where sensitive KGB training and planning could be undertaken, and where intense interrogation and elimination of captives could be undertaken without risk of discovery or interference. He ordered Rally Tabaka's men to give construction of his own beach compound the utmost priority. On his next visit, he found that the fencing and defences had already been laid out, and that work on the interrogation block and the officers' quarters was far advanced. On his return to Havana, he requisitioned the necessary radio and electronic equipment and had it flown out to Tercio Base on the next available transport.